It was a bit late from yesterday lecture that I didn't get to cover, so let me do it today. So we had arrived to write down a BRST charge. And now we are equipped to discuss the BRST homology of the spectrum for the Hilbert space and find the spectrum of strings. Notice that Q is written as a sum of something holomorphic, something that only acts on holomorphic modes, and something that is going to act on anthelomorphic modes. So for simplicity, let me focus on holomorphic modes. So which sort of states could be in the cohomology of this? It's pretty complicated looking beast. But most of the mileage we are going to get from the observation that Q with D gives me L. So Q, remember, Q with B was T. So Q of the BNs gives me the LNs. This kind of tells you that the LNs are Q exact. The generator, Virasoro generators are Q exact, which ultimately will, is what motivates the fact that only operators which are annihilated by the LNs can be closed, and operators which are generated by LNs are exact. But let me try to demonstrate that directly. As I mentioned, it's pretty natural to consider this ground state G as a Gauss state. Of course, we should really look at all possible states for the Gauss and the scalar fields and look for the cohomology. But let's start from something that looks like this. A matter field state, so it's some state for the axis, tends to the ground state for the Gauss. And notice that by definition, the BNs kill G for n greater or equal to 0. Now, that means that if I do this, I can rewrite it as an anti-commutator. So that means that if M tensor G is closed, is Q closed, then it must be that Ln annihilates M tensor G. Because here, if B acts, it kills G. If Q acts, it kills this. So when we look for, if you're looking for Q-closed states of this form, we can restrict to things that are killed by the LNs for n bigger than 0. Now, the LNs have two parts. One made out of scalar fields, the other made out of the Gauss. And it's easy to see that the positive LNs kill the Gauss, kill the ground state. It's the ground state after all. And with a little bit of work, you can also compute the action of L0 on this ground state. We should have probably done it yesterday, but I didn't do it. And L0 on the ground state gives you minus 1. Somehow this vacuum, the state 0 we define, has 0 energy. This ground state is lower than the vacuum and has energy minus 1. is something you can call, you can compute, for example, from these sort of expectation values of t. If you remember, we had computed that the expectation value of t between 0 tilde and 0 was essentially 13 over 12 minus 13 over 12. And we defined t as sum of ln e to the minus ns minus 13 over 12. But this definition, this comes from the fact that c is minus 26. So in a general theory, the stress tensor on the cylinder is decomposed in modes like this. Okay? Sorry, I mean 24. Okay, so in particular, the vacuum has zero eigenvalue for a zero. And that means the ground state, which is C1, C1 bar acting on the vacuum, has eigenvalue minus 1. And so now we've learned that the Bierstein homology must satisfy ln x m equal to 0 for positive n, and ln x, L0 x m equal to minus, to plus m. So we found that A, we discussed several lectures ago, remember? When we're doing quantization by hand, we said, okay, the states of a string must be annihilated by L0 minus A, but we didn't know what A was. And now we learned that A was 1. It comes from the Gauss, L0. Now, of course, you could ask me, why are you looking at this particular kind of states? Maybe you can find other states with other quantum numbers for the Gauss. And it is a pretty messy theorem to prove that all the Bierstein cohomology is essentially built like this, or using things like that. So you can add a C0 or a C0 bar. But doesn't really matter. So now we can also look at exact states. Again, you can say, OK, suppose that my m was ln of something. L minus n of something. These are the states which I wanted to throw, the null states we wanted to throw away when we do things by hand. Well, let's see what happens. If we act with Q on B minus N and tilde, we're going to get L minus N and tilde plus something which has some Gauss. Now it can be shown, again, it's a little bit of a pain, that you can keep adding stuff here with more and more Gauss to keep canceling this until you get to this. Of course, I meant tensor G. So this shows that the states we were throwing away before will be thrown away in a proper treatment as well. Yeah, so there is this no-Gauss theorem which says, OK, this is what's actually happening. The BRST cohomology string theory is of this form, essentially. And it has a nice positive definite inner product. So the sort of states, tower of states we found when we did things by hand, you know, the tachyon, the graviton, the dilaton, the B field, and all the massive states of the strings are recovered as Q cohomology in this proper treatment. Yes?
What's the essential thing about these states, that they're product states, or that the ghost side is just a G?
Well,
what's important to you?
As I was saying, so these states are the most natural thing you would write down when you want to describe states of the original Nambu-Goto action. Because this ground state is implementing all the reasonable boundary conditions on your diffeomorphisms, and then, so on the ghosts, which are dual to the diffeomorphisms. So as I was saying yesterday, more or less, there is some boundary conditions to be put on matrix and diffeomorphisms to get some reasonable classical solutions of strings coming in or going out. These constraints then end up imposing constraints on the ghosts you use, which are pretty much encoded by this state G. So it's pretty natural that in a proper BRC quantization, the states that you use will be some matter states, some states of the X fields, times the state of the ghosts. Right, this ghost, the BRC charge acting on this is particularly simple. And is it such that when you look at this whole state, the condition for this to be Q closed is pretty much the same as we found by hand, with all the uncertainties fixed. In a sense, this might look anticlimactic. Why did you make so much effort to learn how to use the ghost? Why didn't I just tell you that A was minus one, that A was one? Kept going. Well, I want you to be able to do calculations. And the ghosts, although they appear minimally in the setup, they do provide some crucial factors that without which the calculations just wouldn't work. Which calculation I'm talking about? I'm talking about scattering amplitude. So this is what I want to do. We have the states, of the string. Now we know what to put inside this, at the endpoints of these tubes coming in. But how do I actually compute something? How do I attach some number to a picture like this? So it looks daunting, right? How do I possibly compute the path integral over the axis and the ghosts on this Riemann surface, on this surface? Well, it turns out that, so there are two steps in understanding that. First, we need to understand what to do with the tubes. And then after we have understood how to do it with the tubes, we can use some standard technology about Riemann surfaces, which are surfaces equipped with a complex structure. Now, in order to deal with the tubes, you can use something called the state operator map. The state operator map is essentially the idea that whenever we have some calculation with some surface, with some tube coming out, and some state inserted here, this calculation can be equivalent to a calculation done in the absence of the tube, but with a local operator, which is somehow dual to the state. So the state operator map will allow us to recast this calculation as a maybe simpler looking, still complicated because of the holes in the surface. But simpler looking a collation with some operator insertions, which encodes the states. Now, this is still complicated if this is a surface with a lot of handles, but at least for tree-level calculations, it's going to be pretty simple, because the tree-level calculation, no, let me leave this picture here. So if I was to do a tree-level calculation, something like this, the calculation will be reduced to calculation on the sphere. Yeah, so this is for particle scattering. So yeah, I was angling the legs a bit badly. No, I just meant. Some three-level amplitude will look like a calculation on the sphere. And as we will see momentarily, calculations on the sphere are also the same as calculations on the plane. And we definitely know how to do calculations on the plane in a free theory. So this reduces this complicated calculation to a much simpler calculation, as long as we know how to do this state operator map. Okay. So where does the state operator map come from? I think the simplest way to understand it is to look at an example. Let's start with our cylinder. Now, we mentioned that our theory, because it's invariant under diffeomorphisms and wild transformations, is invariant in particular under redefinitions of your coordinates, which are complex coordinate transformations. In particular, let's say that we use this map, this complex transformation. We define a new variable z, which is e to the s. Remember, S was tau minus I sigma. So what happens to this, to the cylinder? How does the cylinder look like in this new coordinate? So let's draw the z-plane. So fixed time and space, if I fix the time and vary space, I get circles centered around the origin. So these circles correspond to this circles. On the other hand, if I fix space and let time vary, I get rays. So a conformal transformation, a holomorphic coordinate transformation, has the property that it preserves angles. See, these rays are still orthogonal. The line time direct, the timelines are still orthogonal to the space lines. But distances have changed a lot. So the cylinder has been mapped to a plane with the origin missing. And so it's natural to ask, Okay, suppose I take some correlation function of, say, my scalar fields. On the cylinder. How does it look like if I map it to the plane? So I can define x of z as just, so I can write x of s as just so x of z as x of, so how do I write this properly? All I want to say is that I can write the derivative of x in the new in the old coordinate as the derivative of x in the new coordinate times e to the s is the Jacobian for the coordinate transformation. So if you remember, this had an expression that looked like e to the s plus s prime over e to the s minus e to the s prime squared. So if I add the Jacobian factors, then this drops out. But this is the same as 1 over z minus z prime square. Which is also the correlation function on the plane of the zx, the z prime of x prime, x of z prime. I hope my z's are distinct from my s's. Call it actually c. Okay. So I did my calculation on the cylinder is completely equivalent to calculation done on the plane. Notice that this is a calculation done on the plane where there was, where the origin was definitely included. So this is the manifestation of a more general phenomenon. Any calculation done on the cylinder with a vacuum inserted in the past and in the future equals the calculation done in R2 and on C. As long as I remember to add all the proper Jacobian factors when I transform the operators.
What are the states on the right side?
There are no states. It's a correlation function on the plane. That's a clear correlation function, path integral on the plane. I mean, you can say that you put your vacuum in the past and in the future, but Euclidean time doesn't really matter. This is just the result of a path integral on the plane.
Should two correlation functions do you reflect some state?
Sure. But when you do calculation on the planes in Euclidean signature, you essentially always assume that you put the vacuum. It's not a state in the same sense, right? There's no, it's a choice of vacuum, not at infinity. It's not the same as picking a state. When you do the calculation on the compact space times time, then you have a Hilbert space also there's to a compact space. And there is a, but when you compute a correlation function, you need to pick a state in the Hilbert space for the past and for the future. But when your space is non-compact, your space-time, Euclidean space-time is non-compact, what you do is to pick a vacuum at infinity, which is not the same as a state. There is no Hilbert space or the theory in the sense of, well, as I said, if I put this, a vacuum in the cylinder, then that's the same thing as doing nothing fancy. Doing nothing fancy on the plane. So So this is the first example of a state operator map. I put the vacuum state here. So the cylinder with the vacuum state. Is mapped to the plane with nothing fancy here. Just the identity operator, if you want,
yeah,
inserted at the origin.
I don't understand what this cylinder picture means. So the cylinder is the space of coordinates t and sigma. So when you draw a state on the cylinder, what do you mean? When you draw a zero state on the cylinder, what does that mean?
You are prescribing a state of the theory far in the past. A state of the theory on the circle. Sorry. So that if I take a two-dimensional theory compactified on a circle, it's essentially quantum mechanics. So I need to pick a state in the past and one in the future to do the calculation.
I guess I don't see what the benefit of. It seems like the Hilbert space is the same after you go to
the Hilbert space for the theory is definitely different on the cylinder and on the plane.
All you change is the coordinates, though, right?
There is no notion of Hilbert space of a theory which is an intrinsic quantity attached to the theory. Hilbert spaces are attached to a choice of space manifold. What is the, remember the, what are states? Okay, let's take a parenthesis here. Suppose I define a theory to a path integral, okay? For example, I take my, let's talk about the scalar field theory. I don't know, in three dimensions, something like that. Okay, I have a path integral of a scalar field with some action. And my path integral is of all fluid field configurations which go to a vacuum at infinity. So when I define my path integral, I'm essentially integrating over phi, which such that phi at infinity equals to some phi zero, which is a critical point of the classical potential and actually quantum effective potential.
The phis are also operated acting on some Hilbert space.
There's no Hilbert space here. So this is the path integral. If I insert some function also the phi, if I insert phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of x3, this defines for me the correlation function of phi of x1 all the way to phi of x3. Okay. Let's think about in the completely discretized system. Think about the Ising model. No, I have the Ising model. This doesn't even need to be continued. The Ising model, I have a bunch of spins in space. I'm summing over all possible choices of spin, and I can insert some observables in that calculation. Okay. When you talk about the Euclidean Ising model, you put it on a lattice, right? For the space Euclidean spacetime, there are no states. Not talking about states,
it's
right?
A classical model. Are you talking quantum mechanically here, or
what's the difference?
The field should be operating on the Hilbert space.
No. This is a Euclidean quantum field theory calculation. It's completely analogous. I can regularize it by discretizing space, Euclidean spacetime. What does it mean, classical or quantum mechanical? Now, the way states emerge here is the following. Suppose I'm computing this path integral over some manifold. Okay. Then I can sort of try to split it into calculation done into this half of the manifold and a calculation done on this half of the manifold. Suppose this is a path integral over fields defined from the manifold to R. Okay. I can try to write this as a path integral over the fields on M1, a path integral over the fields on M2, and a path integral over the fields on the boundary between M1 and M2. We call this the boundary of M1, which is the same as the boundary of M2. Okay? So this path integral can be written as a path integral over fields defined on M1, a path integral over fields defined over M2, and a path integral over the fields defined on the boundary of M1. Now, this path integral will be a function of the value of the fields on the boundary. So I'm integrating over, say, all the functions, all the possible values of the fields on M1, with some fixed value here. So the result of this path integral would be some functional of the value of the fields on the boundary of M1. This other this other path integral on M2 will be again some functional over the state of the fields on the boundary. No, I do the calculation. Now you can interpret this as an inner product in some vector space. You can say, okay, this path integral over M1 produced a functional over the fields on the boundary, which is like a Schrodinger picture of a state. And a state is a function of positions, say. This is another state created by this path integral. And the total path integral is an inner product of these two states. So in general, in quantum field theory, the way states emerge is you cut your space-time manifold in two. And then there is a vector space where your partial path integrals live. And the total path integral is inner product of this. Now, if you're studying quantum mechanics, not a quantum field theory, then your space-time is a line. You're cutting your line at the point, right? And then your functional will be, say, a function of x, function of your position of your particle. Now, when you analytically continue from Euclidean to Minkowskian, this space of functional really becomes a space of states. This inner product becomes the Hermitian inner product in space-time. So in general, the idea you should have in the back of your head is that I have a quantum field theory. A quantum field theory is something that associates things to other things. It tells me to each point in space-time, there is a list of operators I can put at that point, and I can use in correlation functions. And it also tells you to each boundary, to each way to cut my space-time, there is a vector space of states of the theory. So, okay. So in here, when we talk about states, we're talking about cutting my space-time like this. And we're discussing what are the states of the theory when the space is a circle. So they are functionals of all possible values of the fields on a circle. When you discuss the plane, maybe this is not the best picture, but I discuss the plane, you could definitely decide to cut it like that and discuss about the space of states on the line. We actually never need to do it. And it's very rare. I don't know of any situations in which it's useful to do it for a conformal field theory. Because we're typically not, just because we're typically not thinking about this conformal field theory in Lorentzian 1+1 dimensional space-time. We could, and then we need to worry what sort of scattering states we can send in our line and try to scatter. It would be probably a big mess because conformal field theories have no particles. There will be some very complicated Hilbert space of the theory on a line. But we're not going to need it. Our states are always referred to things on a circle. And so, yes, I could in principle say this was, here there was the vacuum for the theory on the line. could have, and maybe I should have. But typically, when you work in flat space in Euclidean time, in Euclidean space-time, this is assumed. So this path integral in Euclidean space-time always produces you the expectation value of the fields on the vacuum of the of flat space. Questions? I know this is perhaps, I'm sorry, I should not have assumed this sort of picture, because it's definitely not something you see when you learn quantum field theory at the beginning, unfortunately. But it's the correct way to think about it.
So if you were to put a different final state on the cylinder,
yes,
would that correspond to putting different boundary conditions at infinity? On
the yes. It would be kind of messy to describe. We will describe them momentarily. But yes, it would be some very messy boundary condition at infinity. On the other hand, putting a different state here would give you an interesting operator insertion here. But let's prove it, okay? Let's say that first of all, let's ask the question, is this true? Okay. Well, as long as your operators are made of X's, you know that this is computed by weak contractions. You know that the two-point function transforms well. So this is also computed by weak contractions. It's pretty clear that the answer is going to be the same. Okay, so a free scalar field, this equality is just a consequence of the weak theorem. There is nothing deeper than that. And of course, it's a consequence of conformal invariance. But you know, if you didn't know about the state operator map, you could have figured out that this must be true just by comparing two-point functions and using the weak theorem. Any questions? So you don't need this to understand anything that I'm going to discuss today. And I'd be happy to discuss this after the lecture as much as needed. It's an important point in quantum field theory. But here, everything in this lecture is supposed to be something you can understand using free field theory. OK, so you don't need that picture. You just need to understand the meaning of these two expressions. This is a path integral on the plane in the free field theory. It's computed by weak contractions using the two-point function of the scalar fields on the plane, the Green function on the plane. Yes?
So it's understood that the right-hand side of this is radially ordered?
No, there is no order. I'm just doing a path integral, OK? I'm just, this is literally defined as integral of dx e to the minus s of x, where x are maps from C, from the plane to R. Okay? I take my x, I expand it in Fourier modes in the plane, I compute the kinetic term, I invert the kinetic term, get the Green function on the plane, and do weak theorem. Yes?
You said that the map from the cylinder to the plane is a conformal transformation, right?
Yes. It's pretty much just an holomorphic coordinate transformation in two dimensions. In general, is a map between two manifolds, which preserves the metric up to a wild transformation. Let's check that this preserves the metric. Okay, and actually, this state operator map holds in any number of dimensions, so we can just check that in any dimension. Let's start from flat space. Okay. Some of you look very unhappy. Please ask questions. So let's write it in polar coordinates. Okay. And now let's make the change of coordinate, r equal e to the t, e to the tau. So this becomes the tau squared e to the 2 tau plus e to the 2 tau, the metric on the sphere. But this is a conformal factor which multiplies the following metric. What is this metric? This is a line times a sphere. So this conformal transformation relates R D to R times S D minus 1. And again, you can ask the question, if I take correlation functions on R D, how do they compare with correlation functions of R times S D minus 1 for a conformal field theory? And you'll find again that if you put your ground, your vacuum in the past and in the future here, the correlation functions here are equal to the correlation functions here, as long as you transform your operators properly under conformal, under coordinate transformations. If you put more general states here, you find an extra insertion here at the origin. But let's prove that. So suppose that we believe this statement, okay? So all of these operators are inserted at points which are not the origin. How do we make it this into something where there is an operator at the origin? Well, we move the operator to the origin, okay? So if I have a situation where I have O, some operator which is inserted at the origin here, I will be tempted to define it somehow as the limit as tau goes to minus infinity. Because bringing an operator to the origin in here is the same as bringing an operator to the past in here. I mean, if this have an equality at every step, the right-hand side is finite as a good limit, better work on the left-hand side too. Now, as I said, we need to be careful to really transform the operators properly when we do this. Here, for example, dx had to be multiplied by e to the s. So in general, so we need to keep this into account. Okay. Particularly nice operators like this guy, and I'll discuss what particularly nice means, had the property that the operator on the cylinder equals e to the delta times s, the operator on the plane, where delta is some number, which is called the dimension of the operator. So you might need to include this. Okay. But this should be your, this should be true. It should be the true that if I have an operator at the origin here, I can obtain it on the cylinder by taking an operator insertion on the cylinder and sending it to the very far past to create a new state by acting on the vacuum. Let's be concrete. Let's see what happens if I try to do it dx. Because after all, so, question, which correlation function on the cylinder gives me this correlation function on the plane? it must be the limit as s goes to minus infinity of e to the minus s of a correlation function on the cylinder with e to the minus s del s x. Yes, but s was, what was s? Tau plus I sigma minus I sigma. Okay, let's see what does this do. We had a specific expression for dsx, right? This was sum of a n e to the minus ns, right? I hope I got the sign right. So what happens when I act with sx on the vacuum on the cylinder? I get the sum for positive n, for negative n, of a n e to the minus ns a n on the vacuum. Now, there are a few nice facts. First, the worst that can happen here is an e to the s, right? Which is already pretty good as you go to minus infinity. And then all the other terms are e to the 2s, e to the 3s, e to the 4s. And in particular, multiplying things by e to the minus s is going to be OK. So what do I get? I get a minus 1 on the vacuum plus e to the s a minus 2 on the vacuum, etc. So if I take the limit as s goes to minus infinity of this, I'm going to take a1 I'm just going to obtain a minus 1 acting on the vacuum. And so we have learned that this equals vacuum in the future, a minus 1 acting on the vacuum in the past. So our state operator correspondence dictionary is improving. Here, I started from the statement that the identity is in correspondence with this state. And next I've learned that the operator dx inserted the origin is one-to-one correspondence with a minus 1 on the vacuum. And now we can keep going. For example, what could possibly be a minus 2 acting on the vacuum? Well, you can check that this is the case. Or what could it be, a minus 1 squared acting on the vacuum? Well, it's going to be the operator dx, dx inserted at the origin. And so on and so forth. There is a one-to-one dictionary between any polynomial in your axis and derivatives and states built out of the vacuum in your Hilbert space. That's nice. It's nice, but unfortunately, it's still not what we need, because we want to be able to insert states with generic momentum in there. So the really tricky question today is, what do I possibly have to do here in order to get this? What do correlation functions on the cylinder with the momentum flowing through mapped to in the plane. Somehow, as you can guess, if there is momentum coming in here, momentum was one of the conserved charges of this theory, it means that here there must be momentum flowing out. I need to have an operator which carries momentum, carries this quantum number of the theory. So questions. So in the 2D, free boson. Which operators carry momentum? Be completely explicit. So this is my conserved current. Which operators carries conserved charge for the conserved current? Clearly not derivatives of x. Mm-hmm. Yes?
What do you mean exactly by an operator carrying a charge?
It means that, for example, when I commute this with the charge operator, suppose I have a charge operator Q hat. When I commute to the dot operator, I must get some charge times the operator. That would mean the operator has charge Q. So now in this case, the charge is essentially, remember, A naught. So how do I construct an operator which has non-trivial is P, right? Commutation relation with P. If I just look in terms of zero mode, I would say, OK, I do something like e to the I PX, right? Well, like alpha X. E to the I alpha X has charge alpha under P. But this is not a local operator, right? Here I'm taking the zero mode of my field. So it's my field smeared all over the space-time, all over space, and exponentiating it. I want a local operator. I want something that can live at a point. So it turns out that the correct answer is this, which is a very strange beast. I can define it on the cylinder, too. So if you expand, see, if you expand x in modes, inside here, there will be in particular e to the I alpha little x. So this operator has a chance to carry momentum. But it's a very strange local operator, because you typically, in quantum field theory, you're not used to see exponentials of fields.
Mm-hmm. The say P is defined as like A0 on the vacuum, right? So why can we...
No, sorry. Okay. It's not created by A0.
I thought it was like the zero mode of the...
That's right. So P satisfies this. Right. But it does not satisfy this, unfortunately. What is true is that e to the I alpha x acting on the vacuum gives me the state of momentum alpha. Now, there are various reasons for which this makes sense only in two dimensions. Part of the reason is that this this field has scaling dimension 0 in 2 dimensions. In higher dimension, you would just expand this exponential into a polynomial, into a sum, infinite sum of phi of operators, which are powers of x. These local operators have completely different properties from each other, different scaling dimension. It would make no sense to add them together. But here, it makes sense. In two dimensions, it makes sense. Of course, we need to understand how to define it. This is a classical sort of expression. What is the proper quantum mechanical way to define this? There are various ways. One is just to try to put it in your path integral. Okay, I have path integral over x, e to the minus s of x. Why don't I just add to my action plus I alpha x at some position s? This seems to be a fair way to do things. Does it work? Well, let's see. What is the, for example, what is the classical action? Suppose I want to evaluate this with a, you know, this is a quadratic in x. This is linear, so this is still a Gaussian integral. I can do it completely explicitly. And it is essentially going to give me, let me write it more explicitly somehow. To really show why there is a little bit of a sickness. If you just do this Gaussian integral, you're going to get something like delta of s tilde minus s, delta of s tilde tilde minus s, Green's function of x. So this path integral essentially gives you this. Okay, if I don't put any insertions. And this is kind of sick because of the two delta functions. We are trying to evaluate the Green. You know, formally, this is trying to give you the Green function at equal points, which diverges. If you remember the Green function, for example, on the plane, is log z minus z prime squared. If you do it on the cylinder, can you see because of the lectern? I hope so. You get something like log of e to the s minus e to the s prime squared or something like that, roughly. So this is pretty bad. But it's not the end of the world. I could try to smear it a little. Okay. And then here I would get that. Right. So okay, this goes to infinity as my smearing function goes back to the delta function. But there is an easy fix. Let me just subtract it from my action. Now, by definition, for every smearing function, this is finite, and the smearing function goes to the delta function, I get a nice limit. So this is one definition of this operator. You insert these, but you renormalize it by this. So in a sense, the quantum mechanical expression differs from the classical expression by some normalization factor. Let's just forget about the normalization factor. I'll just write this to indicate the quantum operator. And you can use this definition to do calculations. Or you can try to use other, compare it with other definitions, such as a normal ordering definition, which is also pretty useful. But before doing that, I would like to just point something out. So this is kind of analogous to the point splitting way of doing things. Okay, and what we subtract here has to be local. So although the Green's function on the cylinder depends, for example, on the size of the cylinder, here I really cannot do that. I really need to subtract something local. What I've subtracted here must be log of s minus s prime squared, like in point splitting definitions. So as you see that as you change your coordinate system, the definition changes a little. If I go from s to some function of s, the logarithm of s minus s prime, so suppose I have some s tilde, which is a function of s, right? If I want to compare the definition in different coordinate systems, I'll have to compare the behavior of log of s minus s prime and the behavior of log of s tilde of s minus s tilde of s prime. Okay. As s and s prime, as s approaches s prime. This is a pretty easy calculation. You get something like log of ds tilde over ds. Okay. That means that when you compare the definition of this vertex operator in some coordinate system or in some other coordinate system, you need to pay this price. This price is exponentiated with an alpha square in front. So the final answer, if I got my factors correct, ends up like this. So it's weird. And it's also pretty beautiful. See, this is essentially telling you this guy has a fractional dimension. It doesn't transform. Like, suppose, for example, I just do a scaling transformation. I take my s tilde to be twice s. Okay? Then my operator would multiply by 2 to the alpha squared. Compare it to the transformation, say, of del x. Right? So del x is dimension 1. This guy has dimension alpha squared. Now, the existence of operators of non-trivial dimension is a very deep phenomenon in quantum field theory. Yes?
So classically, this is just a function of x, which has scaling dimension 0.
That's right.
So we would expect it to have scaling dimension.
That's right.
But through the renormalization, we pick up the scale.
That's correct. That's correct. So this operator required renormalization in order to be defined. This renormalization was multiplicative. It was an implicit multiplicative renormalization. And as a consequence, the coordinate the anomalous scale transformations are multiplicative. In more conventional situations where your operators are just polynomials of the fields, as you encounter in higher dimension, typically your renormalization might be additive. Oh, well, sometimes it's also multiplicative, but no, that's not fair. It's also multiplicative. This operator is getting a dimension much in the same way as it happens in other situations. It's just that here it manages to do so even in a free theory. So the theory itself didn't need renormalization, but the operator needed it. And the.
So there also like a limit for just taking these f functions to delta functions?
Yes.
So like some limit is f over 0.
That's right. Okay. That's right. Yes. That's right. Now that we go to this, we can try to compare this messy definition with a more straightforward definition involving normal ordering. For example, I can just try to define an operator because this is a free field theory, by doing this. Okay? This is fine, and it will produce pretty much the same answer. Because after all, what we did here was to subtract off, at least on the plane, was to subtract off the vacuum expectation values. But let me see. Yeah, there is something else in the note, but we don't really need it. All I wanted was to just check if this works. Okay. So let's just say it works. So it is true that if you write the momentum mode as e to the I alpha x acting on the vacuum, you can obtain it indeed by taking the limit as s goes to minus infinity, e to the minus alpha squared over 2s, e to the minus alpha squared over 2s bar, e to the I alpha x of s and s bar acting on the vacuum. The details of the calculation are in the note. But anyway, so these vertex operators accomplish what we needed. They allow us to take these momentum modes of the string and just transform them into local operators. But I'll go over that in detail in the next lecture. Now you can ask, how do I compute correlation functions involved in this? But it's a free field theory. You just use weak contractions. This regularization makes it so that you don't need to contract x with itself inside the exponent. All you have to do is to contract x with other x's in your correlation functions or in other exponents. Or you can go back to the definition, literally do the path integral. Okay. So you suppose that I have two of these terms added to the action. So now I have this sort of expression, but now there will be an F1 plus F2 times F1 plus F2. The F1 squared terms and F2 squared terms are eliminated by the regulator. And the mixed term F1, F2 gives me something like e to the alpha 1, alpha 2, Green's function at S1, S2. So this is what comes out of doing something like e to the integral of alpha 1 delta of S minus S1 plus alpha 2 delta of S minus S2. Alpha 1 delta of S tilde minus S1 plus alpha 2 delta of S tilde minus S2 G of S tilde. So if I just do the Gaussian path integral with two of these insertions, just using delta functions for simplicity, I get something like that. These two terms are eliminated by the regulator. These are eliminated by the regulator. And the mixed terms give me that. And remember that this is a log. You discover that, for example, in flat space, you get expressions like Z1 minus Z2 to alpha 1, alpha 2, say. On the cylinder, you get something similar with exponentials inside. So we have all the tools that we need to compute string theory amplitudes. Well, okay, fine. I didn't give you the state operator map for the ghosts. That will be the first thing we do tomorrow.